Thank you very much, Howard. Hoping everybody can hear me. If anybody can't hear me, if they'd like to just unmute and just let us know. Great. So I'm going to be talking about, as Howard said, I've been doing FinChat, or I've been traveling to China off and on business for the last kind of 20 plus years. So it's been a kind of interesting experience dealing with, I deal with the print industry in China. Our company runs a print exhibition. So I'm not really going to be giving a kind of scientific analysis of state capitalism. I think that probably most of us on talk this morning understand what that means. Where the state basically is extracting value, where the state owns, has exclusive ownership of the means of production, but it's still all the features of a capitalist system. But what we've seen in China, Deng Xiaoping has reformed, free market reforms of the 1990s, which effectively allowed state-run enterprises to be broken up. And create a space for, if you like, private capitalists to enter the market, even in some cases in competition with state-run enterprises, and particularly where these were non-strategic areas, if you like. So particularly the areas that we're looking at, which is the print industry, as an example. So when I first arrived in China, those reforms were just working through. So the people that I was meeting 20 years ago and the people that I meet today are, if you like, the beneficiaries of the opening up policies of Deng Xiaoping. But what we'll also kind of see when we move slightly outside the print industry as well is that it's created a lot of tensions within the state bureaucracy, within the Communist Party of China, because what is happening has been unleashed in terms of kind of the need for creativity, certain amount of freedom to develop intellectual property. It's clashed in many cases with the state's need for total control of all aspects of Chinese life, and this is creating some tensions, which we're now seeing kind of worked out. If you look at what's happening with the Alibaba case, for example, or the Chinese states now wanting to get involved in the cultural industries. But we'll come to that later on. I'm going to start off really by talking about very briefly about my time in China. I lived out in Shanghai for probably 4 or 5 months, and I helped set up the company's China operations. So dealing with the bureaucracies, the bureaucrats in China. I've got my own medieval shop, which I use to seal documents, all that sort of fun stuff. So if you have a look at I'm just going to, all these photographs are numbered here. This is the first one you see here is, this is back in 2004. This is in the south of the country, in Shenzhen, which is kind of one of the big industrial powerhouses. It's just a relatively small municipality. You can see the size of that square. This is where they have the parades and such like. If you move down to photograph two, that's basically the municipal offices. And again, this will be a kind of base of size of, I suppose, a relatively small municipality on the outskirts of Shenzhen. What's interesting here, you can see there's a very small Chinese flag there. In the middle of that photograph, number two. But there are no statues. It's quite incredible, really. The party, obviously, under Mao and his immediate successors, were using Marxist-Leninism as a legitimizing force. But everywhere that I traveled in China, I've never seen one statue of Marx or Engels or even Mao. So that took me by surprise a little bit. I was expecting much more of the kind of Soviet era kind of statuary to be there, but it's really not. Number three, photograph number three you can see there the lot of the building going on. This is the outskirts of Shanghai. This is where we have exhibitions in Shanghai, up in the centre north, and also in Shenzhen in the south. So you can see the kind of scale of the building work's going on here. Shanghai's 34 million people, and increasing in size every day. The COVID pandemic has slightly reduced that total. A lot of the countryside people have gone back to their villages, compelled to go back to their villages. But obviously, if the state isn't really using Marx or Lenin or Mao or any of those kind of figures as legitimizing force, it's really much more traditional. It's the role of the bureaucratic state in China 2000 years ago, which was to protect the outer borders of the country, to meet the physical needs of the population, and provide some sort of redress against corrupt officials. So just in terms of housing, you can see here this new housing estate. These are going up all over the outskirts of Shanghai, creating a lot of conflict with the local farming community, who are very often just forced off their land. There have been a lot of clashes, including violent clashes. And when I was in Hong Kong just before it was handed back to China, bookshops in Hong Kong Airport, a lot of journalists, kind of citizen journalists in China, were writing about these growing conflicts between the people in the countryside and the developers. You can't buy those books anymore in Hong Kong Airport since the recent crackdown. But it's more extensive than the state would like you to think. So this is one of the challenges to the grip of the Communist Party of China on the country. On number four. This is a maglev. I'm just putting this in as a kind of touristy photograph, but it's pretty impressive. This is the magnetic levitation train that connects the airport, Shanghai Airport, to Pudong, which was just on the north bank of the river. It was a swamp, basically, about 25, 30 years ago. It was a swamp, and now it's one of the spectacular examples of urban design anywhere in the world. It's huge. It's a huge site. And this basically is a maglev. It's travels at speeds of 431 kilometers an hour, 268 miles an hour. It's basically takeoff speed for a jet airliner. Really impressive. Anyway, number five. This is the kind of typical shopping experience in Shanghai. The tradition has become kitsch in China amongst younger people. It's been consumerized. You can see here, this is some old area of the market place in Shanghai. But you can see that sort of bouncy castle thing going on there on the left-hand side. Picture number seven and number eight. So you can see here, this is the area of Shanghai that I was living in. You really wouldn't know, apart from obviously the Chinese language symbols, that you weren't living in Boston or New York or London. Again, there are really no statues. There are no banners, promoting the party or promoting sort of Marxist-Leninism or Maoism or nothing at all. And in fact, in number eight, you can see that was just up from where I lived. You can just see behind that cat going up the escalator. Seven. Sorry, I'm getting it mixed up. Yeah. So, photograph seven. You can see the guy in the black shirt there going up the escalator, and just behind his head, you can see the golden arches. So all the big brands, global brands, present in China, with pretty much no restriction on ownership. So all the big Marks, Carrefour. Spot number eight. Again, there's some put here, tradition, not party. Most Chinese people who I've met are strongly traditional in their sort of kind of sense of values, you know, very much looking back to the days of China, the Middle Kingdom, and great and glorious past, and, you know, buying the whole narrative that then it was torn apart by the imperialist powers, but is now, you know, reasserting itself. So tradition in that sense holds a major part in Chinese people's lives, and the party is really really going after that to in terms of ensuring its legitimacy, rather than harking back to what it called Marxism, Leninism, or Maoism. It's building on those old kind of imperial traditions of multiple thousand years ago traditions in China. Number nine, you don't have to look far though to find grinding poverty in Shanghai. Although when you're shown around the city by the official miners, they don't like to point this out, but you can see it there. There's a lot of poverty. The people who come to the countryside to build all these housing estates basically have no rights. They only have rights in the provinces in which they're born, to childcare, social services. So these are almost like kind of, you know, temporary squatter camps. Slide 10. This is the exhibition centre where we have our show. Militarization, I mean, the police force is armed. These are just the guys who basically, these are the security guards, you know, for the show. But it's a very military, militarized, you know, people aren't given a chance to forget that behind the fact that you're allowed to shop as much as you like, there is the iron fist in the velvet glove. It's never very far away. Number 11, I'm talking here about the fact that apart from tradition, most Chinese people just love to shop. So consumerism really is a guiding principle for or value for many people. This, and they're very advanced. I mean, so this photograph is our office in Shanghai. This is a vending machine. And basically what you do is you just scan a QR code, which automatically debits your bank account from your Weibo account, and automatically tells the supplier to replace that item. Number 12, these are domestic Chinese brands. So although the Chinese market, consumer market, is dominated by Western brands, it's pretty familiar stuff, Procter & Gamble and Unilever and such like, the Chinese brands are making an attempt to establish their own market niche and competing with the global brands. One of the problems that they've had is that in the early days of things like baby formula, milk powder and such like, there was a lot of bad manufacturing practices. I mean, a lot of people died or got seriously ill from those products. So they're having to kind of rebuild. The Chinese brands are having to rebuild kind of air of trust. But you can see here that the level of kind of decoration of these brands is, you know, on a par with what you're seeing from the global brands. And actually, that's what our exhibition's about, as you'll see in a minute. It's all about people who print these labels. Number 13. This is a printing press. These are the guys who print the labels, both for the Western brands and for these challenging, you know, Chinese brands. This is a small factory. You'll see some more photographs of these label printing factories later on. But just to kind of show you what it looks like inside a Chinese printing plant, not much different from what you see inside a printing plant anywhere else in the world. But you wouldn't have seen that, you know, 20 years ago. You wouldn't have seen that. So this is a kind of new smaller entrepreneurs who are now kind of, you know, breaking through the system and now becoming bigger, starting to see mergers and acquisitions, etc. But anyway, that's kind of typical sort of label printing plant. So this is our show, number 14. Again, the old traditional thing that you need to have the dragons there. The sites need to be built with the correct feng shui. People tend to buy machinery at times of propitious times of the year or propitious dates. So So, like I said earlier, you know, it's easier to sort of dismiss this as, you know, a superstition, which we would. But nonetheless, you know, it's very much does drive a lot of the big building projects, a lot of the buying decisions, and you know, we have to kind of take on board this. So it's not considered to be lucky unless you had these. These guys are amazing acrobats, by the way. If you've ever seen these dragons at Chinatown somewhere in the UK or elsewhere, pretty amazing. So slide 15, yeah. So this is the show called Label Expo. This is in 2005. There's me looking a little bit embarrassed there on the left-hand side of things. But this is basically you have to have a deal with the local associations. So the Chinese guys that you see here are the guys who represent the Chinese printing associations. The role of these associations in this transition between fully state capitalist and, if you like, a kind of private entrepreneurial capitalist system, one of the ways the state keeps control is through these trade bodies. But they're like the kind of conveyor belt, really, for policies which are agreed by the executive and then pushed through the sort of various representative bodies. And every industry has their own. The print industry has one. Even the label printing industry, has its own trade association. So, for example, one of the big projects in China at the moment is a sustainability, green, environmentalism. And one of the reasons was because the pollution in Beijing and in Shanghai was getting to a stage in the pollution of water sources and the air. It's getting to a stage where, again, it was threatening the livelihood of the workforce. And again, because, you know, the state absolutely felt the need to step in here and force entrepreneurs and force even like state companies to implement more environmentally benign policies, one of which, for example, was taking the solvents, eliminating the use of solvents from the printing process. So the way it works is that that company that you saw earlier, the printing company you had earlier, they're not being told to do this stuff, not being told by these trade bodies to stop using solvents. But if they don't stop using solvents, then they like to find it's more difficult to get finance. They like to find that their customers start to walk away. But these are the kind of unofficial levers of power. Okay, so number 17, that was our offices. I live just on the other side of that block. But you can see the kind of scale of the building in Shanghai. This is just a very minor suburb on the outskirts of Shanghai. Talk now about a visit to slide 18, a visit to a printing company that was located right next to the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze. So it's the biggest dam in the world, so it's a slightly sort of touristic diversion. But, I mean, you can see the scale of that dam. And number 19, so that's a lock. They're the lock gates. You can get pretty much an oil tanker up through those lock gates. Number 20, so this is a company. This is a printing company, Hubei Golden Three Gorges printing industry company. Again, you can see here that the only flag, there are flagpoles there, and there's a Chinese flag, but, you know, we were there, so they rolled out the English flag again. No complete absence of any kind of statuary here. Number 21, picture 21, this is the building. This is the facade of the print building. You can see that these entrepreneurs, the new entrepreneurial class in China, anybody who's seen Brass, that old fantastic TV sitcom with Timothy West and a lot and Westwood, and about how the Victorian entrepreneurs love to big themselves up and building these enormous great factory facades in the classical style. So their successes now in China are no different. You can see the lovely big Grecian pillars here and all that sort of good stuff. 22. So this is inside the blueprint plant. So this is a kind of this printing press here that you can see printing William Morris cigarette cartons. So in China, there's a massive issue in the cigarette market with counterfeit. So you can see what's running through that printing press there are holograms. So there are multiple kind of ways that they try to secure these Western brands against counterfeit. And the kind of sophistication of machinery demands that they import Western machinery. So, for example, this printing press is from an Italian company called Omet. And really because at the moment the sophistication of the Chinese machine building industry isn't quite there yet to be able to develop quite these machines, but as we'll see later, that is starting to change. 23. So here they are. This is the new capitalist class. These two gentlemen are the owners. As with many factories, newly privatized factories in China, or many of these new entrepreneurs, this used to be a state factory. So as I said earlier, a lot of the state factories were turned over to entrepreneurs, or entrepreneurs were allowed to buy out certain parts. It's like in the Soviet Union, in some cases it would pass directly on to in a corrupt manner to other kind of party members who then became the owners, the entrepreneurs. But in the print industry, I have to say that most of the people that I've met really have kind of come up from the bottom. You know, they weren't party functionaries. They were, generally speaking, people who operated printing presses with their technical expertise, who kind of saw a niche, managed to get backers, and then have taken over and started working in these factories. So 24, again, as I said earlier, you don't see much in terms of kind of statuary. This is on the Three Gorges Dam, and it's kind of close as I've seen to those kind of heroic kind of Soviet era kind of power to the workers type things. It's pretty impressive, but of course it does just skate over the fact that of the environmental devastation that the dams caused, and also the hundreds of thousands of people who were uprooted, usually forcefully, to you know, to make room for the project as the valley was flooded. But again, that's quite a rare sight. It's quite a rare sight to see that kind of harking back to that kind of 50s, 60s iconography. So 26. So these are the owners. It's 26 and 27 and 28. These are the owners of other printing plants. They are the owners, and they are allowed to own the factory. The land itself is still in some cases owned by state owned agencies. In other cases, it's jointly managed with private companies. In a limited number of cases, entrepreneurs are allowed to buy the land as well. But technically in China, all the land is still technically owned by the state. So that's the kind of area of some you know, potential dispute. As you'll see in 26, again, we talked about the role of tradition and the tea ceremony. So whenever you visit a plant in Guangzhou, Shenzhen, anywhere in the south, they have these amazing tables. You basically flips over. It's a desk 1 minute, and they flip it over. They plug in the hot water, and there it is, and they just drink this like really delicious green tea for the whole day. But it's going to have again sort of mystical properties, as well as being a kind of a staple of how business is done. You see in 27, so you can see the just in the front there of that photograph of the kind of products which is being printed in that factory. To feed the sort of Chinese consumer hunger. These are against Chinese brands looking to compete with Western brands. And again, 28, It's another big, big print factory. That's the chap who owns it. Very, very important to have the dragons. Again, the feng shui, the way the building faces, the internal design, the way the corridors are built, the amount of light and windows and such like, still very much laid out according to those kind of, you know, traditional superstitions. So again, and you can see here the dragons again, very important lion type dragon type stuff. And that factory that you can see there in 28, below that, so you can see with the yellow truck in front, that is the print factory. It's massive, absolutely enormous. And again, that used to be a state. I think that used to be a state printing plant. Just basically took over the assets, stripped it out, completely gutted inside, rebuilt it, and it's now a modern printing plant. But the actual structure of the plant was used to be an old state run plant. 31 again is another factory, and these are the owners. And 32 again, another typical printing plant. So you can kind of see the kind of scale of these operations. And in this one, it wasn't even a party flag. I mean, it was, you could literally have been anywhere in the world. And when you walked into the reception, there was no sign at all that, you know, it wasn't just for our benefit. There were other photographs of other people having visited, Chinese people as well. And there was no sign at all of the party flag. It hadn't really been anywhere in the world. Number 33, I just found it slightly amusing. This was one of the bigger factories that we visited. The owner really was, he was a rich guy. You know, he drove, he had a fleet of BMWs and Mercs, and he had this, you know, this is his office. And he had this enormously expensive and fantastic, anybody who's into audio, valve-driven amplifier for his CD player and his big speakers around the room. So these guys know how to live well. 34, so this was, this is, I think it's from 2003, 2004. So what's happening in the early days when I was doing business in China was that the Chinese capitalists who wanted to compete with the Western printing press suppliers were starting to build their own machines, but they were direct copies of Western machines. And anybody who kind of remembers the Japanese motor bike industry and the way that they started off by doing kind of pretty bad copies of Western bikes, and then started to work out just make them reliable, you make them cheaper, and then you pinch on the market, and then gradually that you're making counterfeit machines or bikes, whatever, but somebody else can always make a counterfeit machine or bike cheaper than you can, so you invest, and gradually you step up the level of technology and machine. But this is a copy of a Canadian machine, which most people were kind of copying back in those days. And you see in 35, it's another print shop. There's the owner there on the right. That printing press is manufactured in North America. So it's pretty much really way more sophisticated than the kind of machine that you see being built above. And because they're having to print labels for the big brands out in China, if you want to print labels for them, you've got to use the same machines that they're used to using in the rest of the world. So hence they have to buy, often reluctantly, sometimes not, but they have to invest in the Western machinery, which of course is, you know, is generally super reliable. And good to go. 36, this is one of our exhibitions. This is an Italian company. This is their Chinese sales team. So again, just sort of shows how the Western companies are selling their presses to print this kind of high-end consumer packaging in China. As I said, things are changing. There's certainly in the last 2 or 3 years, the Chinese printing press manufacturers have now got the stage where their machines are pretty much as good as the kind of entry-level Western machines, and now they're starting to exhibit those machines them at our shows in Brussels and in the US. So it's fun to kind of go through that curve that you saw with the Japanese motorbike industry. It does mean that also within the, if you like, this small portion of the Chinese capitalist class, there are tensions between those who want to build Chinese machines for the Chinese market and those factory owners who want to import Western machines. So there's all sorts of clashes about between those two groups that we're familiar with pretty much anywhere in the world, where there are divisions between the interests of different sections of the capitalist class. So, for example, when China went to had the border clashes with India, the Indian government then banned Chinese companies from importing their machinery. We have a label show, printing show in India, and the next thing we know, all the Chinese manufacturers were all told that they couldn't bring their machines into India. So they all lost a lot of business in that. Okay, so I'm going to just finish now with a couple of slides, just looking at the kind of wider context of what we've seen here in a kind of a microcosm. So the fear in China is that in the state is that they're starting to lose control. That having unleashed, if you like, entrepreneurism, and as we've seen, there are certain you know conditions that entrepreneurism needs, private capitalism needs to thrive, and there's a certain amount of intellectual freedom, the ability to establish IP. The ability to trade freely, to buy materials and goods and technology from different sources. But as you can see here in slide 37, certainly Alibaba, which is probably the biggest e-commerce, certainly in China. I don't know, globally, but certainly it dominates the Chinese market. A big crackdown now on Alibaba. So its parent company, the Ant Group, was forced to pull out of its IPO. They've now, the crackdown on Alibaba has now extended to Hangzhou, which is a kind of silicon city in China, and 25,000 party cadres in leadership positions in the city, as well as those who retired from the last 3 years, are now having to undertake self-examination to see whether they were corruptly involved with Alibaba as it's in its kind of rise to dominance. So you can kind of see the signs here. If you look at 38, is it a real thought now that amongst the Chinese Communist Party that corruption is now at a level where it's threatening the party's legitimacy? As we said earlier, the party has kind of abandoned any kind of attempt to get its legitimacy from Marxism, Leninism, Maoism. It's very much doing what rulers in China have traditionally done, and the fight against corruption, even sort of back to 2,500 years ago, was always the big weakness of these regimes, because obviously there was no way, apart from individual petitions, that people could get rid of a corrupt official. But you can see now there is this clampdown against wealth and against growing inequality. The question is, what are they going to do? Because they need to encourage, they want to encourage entrepreneurism, they want to encourage growth now through consumerism rather than China being the factory workshop of the world. And all these contradictions now are arising. So if you look at 39, what's also happening now is there's a big clampdown. It's the other side of that clampdown against the most egregious examples of wealth accumulation are an attempt to clamp down on the culture which surrounds that. So, for example, if you look at what's happening in the music industry. So the Chinese state, you've got companies like Tencent, TikTok, ByteDance, all these companies who have been tremendously successful in the West by kind of effectively encouraging, you know, guerrilla videos and, you know, guerrilla filmmaking sort of stuff. Now, the Chinese state now wants to take and is taking a share in these companies. So Beijing recently acquired a small minority stake in ByteDance just the other month, for example, and it looks like they're going to be taking the same approaches with these other music video groups. And just more recently, the CPC banned music from its 50,000 karaoke venues, which insults or defames others. And if you look at some of the characteristics now that you're not allowed to have in music on video, which harms national unity, sovereignty, or territorial integrity, endangers national security, or harms national honor of interest, violates the basic principles determined by China's constitution, incites ethnic hatred, or ethnic discrimination, or contrary to public morality. So you're starting to hear again all of those little kind of echoes of the cultural revolution. But the question is, you know, whereas Mao had absolute power, and the Communist Party had absolute power, then now there are other sources of legitimacy, power, and even authority amongst the sort of young generation in these burgeoning new cultural outlets. So this last photograph here, this is Mr. Tan, delightful fellow. Mr. Tan really kind of sums up a lot of these trends, just as impacts us in the label industry, but also the wider trends that we've been talking about. So Mr. Tan was a real survivor. So, you know, he was he survived all the purges of the Cultural Revolution. He was a printing expert. I mean, the guy really is truly he's written encyclopedias of the print industry. He's encouraged development, adoption of more environmentally friendly printing policies in China. And he's a lovely chap, and every time that I saw him, he'd always give me a gift of some very wonderful wonderful tea. Call it the Ginger Root. So the Ginger Root is when you're looking for a partner in China, it's which of these now competing state agencies, because the state agencies now have been semi-privatized, so they all have to make money. So what you think is a state regulatory agency you have to do a deal with actually turned out to be some chancers from the environmental agency who set up their own business to kind of gullible Western companies like ours to give them lots of money to get permission to run shows and such like. But we were pretty sure that with Mr. Tan's organisation, so it proved, you know, last 20 shows. But what's now happened is that now Mr. Tan has sadly retired. His successor is now basically saying he doesn't want nothing that a Chinese company couldn't do, run his shows. He wants to see. So he's very much representative of that other faction of the capitalist class in this area. He wants to encourage Chinese manufacturer to have Chinese companies running these exhibitions. So the strategy for our company will be to exactly find another one of these kind of competing bureaucratic semi-privatized outlets who have power elsewhere in the system, and basically do a deal with them. So that's the reality of working in modern day China. So with that, I'd just like to thank everybody for listening in, and hand you back to Howard.